From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Congressman Steve Scalise was shot along with an aide.
Otto Warmbier, the American held in prison in North Korea. He has died at the age of 22.
It was an all-nighter up here on the Senate as Democrats are railing against Republicans for writing their health care bill behind closed doors.
We've been meeting with potential people that may be of service to this administration. I don't think that should come as any surprise, but we're always looking for ways to do a better job of articulating the president's message and his agenda.
Many of our federal systems are decades old, with our 10 oldest being between 39 and 56 years old.
You stated some facts. First of all, you've now said that he is being investigated after saying that you didn't.
No.
You just said that he's being investigated.
No, Chris, I said that the let me be crystal clear so you completely understand.
In Georgia's 6th congressional district, Republican Karen Handel defeated Democrat John Ossoff by about 52% of the vote to 48%. The race had been seen as a check on how some voters feel about the Trump administration.
And we'll start with that news there. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining me as always is Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Kevin McManus, political science professor at Trinity College here in Hartford. Hello there, Kevin.
Hello.
And Susan Bigelow is here, contributor at ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
So let's start with that news about the Georgia special election, called the most expensive, highest profile, most hyped special election for a single seat in the House of Representatives since, well, the beginning of time. I don't know, Colin, A, did it live up to the hype? And B, as you look at all the analysis going in, that this is going to be a referendum on the Trump administration, I mean, is that what we ended up with?
You know, probably this thing has been kind of over-curated and over-speculated about. I mean, you know, politics do tend to be pretty local. There's been probably an unprecedented concerted effort to make this not a local election. So money is, of course, poured in from all kinds of outside sources, which often gets people very jumpy locally. Like, where's all this money coming from? Probably a bigger problem for the Democrat. He doesn't live in the district either. After a while, all that stuff starts to add up. And as you and I were talking about earlier this morning, there's also what we might now call the Linda McMahon effect, where, you know, at a certain point, people have seen too many commercials and been hassled too much about their vote. Setting all that aside, the one thing that I would say is that the Democrats and Democrat-leaning analysts probably have to stop saying, well, they overperformed in this district or over. There was also the South Carolina election where actually, if you look in terms of overperforming, the Democrats in particular overperformed there. But, I mean, that's not this – I don't know. There used to be this football coach who said close only counts in horseshoes, hand grenades, and drive-in movies. And, you know, at a certain point, you have to acknowledge that about politics, too. The fact that you came close or you overperformed or you did better than whatever the benchmark was from the last cycle – you know, I don't know how meaningful that ultimately is. Yeah, I mean, you have to start winning elections.
That analysis, Kevin, I kind of waking up to it felt a little shocking to me. With all of the buildup and all of the hype about this election, the idea that close enough for horseshoes or hand grenades is going to get it done for Democrats seems like an odd way to spin what it actually turned into a couple of defeats in opportunities for Democrats to pick up seats in the House.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think, you know, if it is a local race, I mean, this is where Democrats or the quality of the candidate can outperform even in a demographically Republican district. If it's more of a localized race, that's where you can see these victories. But when you have a nationalized race that's been going on for months now, so much money spent, so much attention to it, then it's harder for that local Democrat to win in such a Republican district.
Yeah,
I
was just going to say, and when everything becomes this as Colin said and Kevin said, this big national issue, you have the specter of big money coming in from the outside, Susan. And one of the problems with big money, I don't know, we've been worried about the influence of money in politics for years, and it is very, very pernicious and it's real. However, in all of these high-profile cases, whether or not it's governor's races or Senate races in Connecticut or the special election in Georgia, every single time a whole bunch of money flows into something, it almost never has the intended effect. I heard lots of stories about people putting up signs saying, no more solicitations. Do not knock on my door asking me to vote for Mr. Ossoff because I'm just not gonna, in part because he just keeps knocking on my door.
No, that's very true. And I think a lot of people wanted a different kind of politics after everything that happened last year, a lot of people voted for something that was different from the way that things had gone before. This felt like such a traditional race where outside groups are pouring tons and tons of money into this. It felt almost a little icky by the end that there was so much outside money going in. And I'm sure that that turned people off. And what Colin said is true, though. Democrats really do need to start actually trying to win these things. And special elections are always a little strange because you never know what the turnout's going to be like. But what was interesting to me was that in 2016, the Democrat got about 125,000 votes. Okay. Lost by a very large margin to Tom Price. And this time, John Ossoff got about 125,000 votes. So they did a pretty good job of turning out those Democrat and Democrat-leaning voters. They didn't seem to be able to convert anybody, really. Republican turnout was down, but not enough. So, yeah, I mean, what was missing here, I think? They didn't really give people something to get excited about and vote for.
Well, and that's a question that's been coming up. I mean, our colleague Kevin Bill Curry has been saying that for years. If Democrats say, well, don't vote against this guy, but they don't have a real plan themselves, they're never going to win elections like this or the House of Representatives or the Senate or the presidency ever again.
Yeah, again, I think if it's a nationalized race, it's easy for Republicans to say, who are you voting for? Are you voting for Paul Ryan or are you voting for Nancy Pelosi? And for a traditional Republican voter in that district, the choice is an easy one, right? So if you can make it a race about not about the two candidates actually running, but about the two leaders of the party, then Republicans are going to win virtually every time.
I'd like to point out the South Carolina race, which was much less heralded, is – and I'm pointing this out to you, John, because I know you're a big fan of House of Cards. It's Frank Underwood's district.
Yes.
The fifth in South Carolina, where he comes from. And actually, the Democrat, Archie Parnell, made some commercials that evoked Frank Underwood as a way of calling attention to his campaign. That's a very, very red district. It's the Mulvaney district, basically. But again, I don't know. Archie Parnell, he's like a Goldman Sachs executive. I'm not really sure that's like the greatest idea in a place like South Carolina. Ultimately, the Democrats really do, just a return to that, have to get that message out. We're here to help you. We actually can deliver on some of the things that were promised to you by the other side during the 2016 campaign of caring about people who are underserved right now, who are not prospering in the American economy. We're the people who can come forward and do this. This is how we're going to do it. The one thing I would say, it would be a mistake by the Republicans to look at these two elections and think, oh, we're okay. We can plan healthcare bills in total secrecy. Nobody minds. We can do whatever we want. That would not be a smart conclusion to draw.
It wouldn't, Susan, but I think it's part of where whenever people complain about a Northeastern media elite or a way of looking at things that is not the way the rest of the world looks at things, I think it's pretty fair to say that a lot of people up here in the Northeast looking at a Georgia race can say, all right, Republicans, are you sick of Trump after however many months? Meanwhile, the rest of America, a lot of whom voted for him and voted for a Republican change or even just a change that had no party attached to it whatsoever, are like, no, you know what? We're actually going to give this a try. I know you guys are sick of it because it's so strange and foreign to you, but I don't know, in a lot of parts of Georgia, this is probably playing pretty well, or at least it's wait and see time for a couple more months.
Absolutely. And what Democrats don't get yet, and maybe they have to really have a wake-up call on this, is that this isn't just about politics or policy. This is so cultural. Everything that's going on for the past year and a half and more has just been culture, culture, culture. And for somebody who lives in Georgia, if you're talking about, well, do you want somebody with Nancy Pelosi's values, left coast, whatever, it's a cultural threat. And that's what turns Republicans out. I really feel for this kind of race, you almost have to sneak up on it. For a deep red district for a Democrat to win, you can't have that kind of media spotlight that the last couple of special elections have had, because then that cultural aspect comes into play.
This was definitely not sneaking up on it.
No.
And as Colin mentioned, the South Carolina, statistically, South Carolina race was actually closer than the Georgia race, even though the Georgia race had greater expectations from a Democratic point of view.
One thing playing into this that's in the week's news, and we'll talk about two stories here. Colin mentioned health care a moment ago, which we'll get to, but also the Supreme Court announced this week that it would consider whether partisan gerrymandering violates the Constitution, reading from the New York Times here, potentially setting setting the stage for a ruling that could, for the first time, impose limits on a practice that has helped define American politics since the early days of the Republic. Look, Kevin, a lot of people think that the real problem here is that we've got all these districts that have been drawn up either in a Republican way or a Democratic way, largely in a Republican way in an awful lot of parts of the country, that makes it impossible for any real change. So the Supreme Court taking on this case could have bigger consequences than almost anything else we could talk about today.
Yeah, as has been in the news recently, the court has certainly been consistently reviewing this question of racial gerrymandering. This is a question of partisan gerrymandering, and if you have many states that are basically 50-50 states in the presidential election, Florida, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, where Republicans, because they control the legislature, the state legislature, because they control the governor's office at the right time, right, when the census is taken and the new lines are drawn, they've been able to have significant advantages by basically aided significantly by computer programming to draw lines that are perfect for them and take full advantage not only at the congressional level but also at the state level.
Colin?
So just to sort of help people understand this a little bit, so the case the Supreme Court is hearing comes out of Wisconsin. The first way you maybe suspect something like this is happening, Wisconsin, I'm this is off the top of my head, I think I have it about right. I think Wisconsin is in their general assembly race. In their assembly races, Republicans got 48.6% of the total vote for representatives. They won 60% of the seats. So, and then you kind of go, well, something's gone wrong here, right? That doesn't seem to make sense. And that's usually how you know these things don't match up as well. Now, they used to be a much more nakedly obvious thing. The term gerrymander comes from a Massachusetts politician whose name was actually Elbridge Gerry, and his district looked like kind of a lizard or a salamander or something like that because it was just so obviously misshapen. Now, with computers and, you know, high-functioning algorithms, it's pretty easy to do this in a way that it doesn't stand out. It isn't usually quite as obvious. The key to all this is creating what are called wasted votes. In other words, to win, you need 50% plus one vote. If you can get the opposing party to waste a lot more votes than that on seats that it's going to win, that obviously depletes and supply of other votes. These are the kinds of things the court will be looking at, and you have to prove intent. You know, an accident usually is sort of a reasonable defense. I think the standard is going to be: did you intentionally use algorithms to create this pattern?
Right, and other countries have a better way of dealing with this than we do. There's no real standard. There's no federal standard for what a district really should look like. I mean, we have some ideas. We have some sort of values about what we'd want it to be. We want it to be compact. We want it to be geographically make sense. Okay. But there, in other countries, like in Britain, they have a boundary commission. And they actually, they're independent. They're not beholden to anybody. They're not political. They just draw the boundaries based on the population. And they have a whole bunch of guidelines to do so. Canada, same thing. There's an independent boundary commission. So in Connecticut, what we have is we have a committee of the legislature that does this every 10 years. And it's made up of an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. And sometimes they can agree on things and sometimes not, at which case they have to bring in this special master. Last time this happened in 2011, this special master kind of kept things pretty much the same, which was to say it was just an incumbency protection machine in a lot of ways, that the districts were drawn to keep people kind of where they were and protect the status quo, which is not necessarily a good thing. So this could actually change quite a lot of things. It'd be great to see some kind of actual standard created to or maybe even an independent commission like they have in California now to oversee the boundary changes.
Not necessarily a good thing unless you happen to hold a seat in the House of Representatives. But anyway, yes.
Yeah, I mean, some states are fairer with regard to how they do it, and others are definitely much more partisan. The thing is, when you it's also tied to this idea of racial gerrymandering, right, that you have so-called majority-minority districts. And what you tend to do there is and you see these strange types of districts that, basically, if you thought about trying to create a majority-minority district in Connecticut, for example, what would you do? You start in Hartford. You drive down to New Haven, right? You go over to Bridgeport, and that wouldn't give you that type of district. So this is back into the 1982 with the Voting Rights Act, the reenactment of the Voting Rights Act. Democrats made this decision that they wanted more African-American, Hispanic-American representatives. What's the alternative? The alternative is that it's more likely that you're going to get more Republicans. So do you get more representation? It's so-called the dilemma of representation. Do you get more representation from these communities and a greater likelihood of a Republican Congress? Or do you, as Connecticut has, look at Connecticut's representatives. You have five Democrats, all of whom are white, right? So that's part of the trade-off.
Thought, Colin?
Ultimately, this is now going to depend on how the Supreme Court perceives this. And I think this is a hard one to pre-guess the court on, too. It would seem as though, just the way the court is constituted, that they're not going to be interested in doing anything about 12 Wisconsin Democrats who feel as though their votes didn't really count for anything. But it might be because of the intellectual heft of this, one where the court will do something a little bit surprising.
A quick thought here from Peter in Stanford. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Yes, I just want to comment on the Georgia race. Turnout was up in the Georgia, and if you compare Georgia to South Carolina, the two candidates from South Carolina combined got the Democratic candidate in Georgia actually got more votes than the two candidates in South Carolina combined. So I think the big money turned out both the Republicans and Democrats in Georgia. It's just it also, you know, turned out the Republicans too. So it did make a difference. I think we inched closer. I think the Democrats inched closer. They closed the gap, but not enough. And I think my theory is in the midterms, I think that the Republicans will still gain control, but the Democrats will make some gains. Maybe the Republican leaning states might flip, but the solid Republican states might lean more Republican, but the margins will close a little bit.
Just because we're up against the break, I just want to get a quick thought from Kevin about that. I mean, does it tell us anything moving forward as we look at 2018, which is, of course, what everyone who follows politics cares about out of these special elections?
Well, I think, you know, if you're sitting in the White House and you were concerned at all about impeachment and concerned about that Donald Trump's name might have hurt the Republican Party brand, he's probably smiling. I don't know if he's tweeted on this at all, but that ultimately, as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, they will make the determination about Donald Trump. And if they're winning races, he's going to be fine.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about this secretive Senate health care bill, whether or not they're actually going to unveil some details about this bill coming up soon. Kevin McMahon, he's a political science professor at Trinity College. Also with us is Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, also Kevin McMahon, a political science professor at Trinity College, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. And what's on your show today, Colin?
We've got a show about where our ideas of beauty come from. When I was at a TEDMed conference last year, I met this very interesting Dr. Anjan Chatterjee, who really kind of studies how we get our ideas of beauty. Is it part of evolutionary adaptation? And how does that affect everything else we do afterwards? Let me just quickly also, just for a second, because it's been promoted heavily here on the station, tell you that if you don't have a ticket to Billy Collins tonight in Farmington, don't show up. They probably will not be letting people in at the door. They've pretty much sold out.
This is Billy Collins at the Sunken poet. Garden Poetry Festival, the famous poet, and they sold it out. That's good. I love it when they sell out poetry events.
Yeah. No, it doesn't happen that often.
That's a good thing. So let's talk a little bit about this health care bill. The Senate's been working, Susan, behind closed doors on the Senate version of this plan. Of course, the House version of this plan to repeal, I suppose, and replace Obamacare was called mean by President Trump after he'd previously supported it. Now, the Senate's been doing this not only just without any sort of Democratic input, but also without a lot of the input from rank-and-file Republicans. People don't know what's in this bill. What we do know is that Americans aren't thrilled by it, whatever it exactly it is. But now they say, Mitch McConnell says, we're going to release something later on this week.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll get something. I think as these sort of barrels headlong toward a vote, which I think he is going to hold eventually, as probably as quickly as he can before people figure out what's in this thing and get too irate about it. I mean, it's a very weird way to try to pass a bill. Mitch McConnell is nothing but sort of canny, though. He's a very canny sort of legislator. And so I figure he must think this thing is just – it must stink. It must be awful for him to do this way and to try to force it through in this fashion. And after a while, I have to think, is it really worth it for you guys to pass something that's really not going to be all that popular?
Yeah, it was interesting, Kevin, on NPR last night. They were talking a little bit about the history of the way the Senate does business. And for a long part of its history, negotiating something like this in private, in secret, and not letting people know anything about it was pretty much the way they did business. Sure. We are kind of consumed by transparency now for very good reasons. But I don't know. I mean, how unusual is it to you that such a massive piece of legislation would be getting worked out without anybody seeing what the heck it is?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, if you compare it to the Obamacare, which went on for, for many months and many discussions, it's a much different process. And what's interesting to me is that you now see Republicans led by John McCain who are sort of coming out and saying, who are criticizing the fact that they haven't seen it, right? So when ultimately they're going to need their votes and whether Mitch McConnell can pull this off, I think is a real question.
And if we're talking about the politics of a call, I think Kevin just pointed out, Obamacare, we heard all about it. We debated it endlessly to the point where by the time it was passed, everyone hated it, right? Because everyone had heard everything about it and they'd formed an opinion about it. Maybe, as Susan said, the canny Mitch McConnell is saying, if we don't tell anybody, then people will know exactly as much as we tell them about it, and then they won't hate it so much.
Yeah, maybe the cannier Mitch McConnell is also thinking about this as a mail truck that the dog doesn't really want to catch. In other words, it might be a pretty good thing for the Republicans. They had a vote on this. It went down in flames, but in a smolder. And I mean, I can guarantee you that any senator right now, Republican senator facing re-election in 2018, is testing as much of this as can be tested in his or her home state. Do you want to run on this thing or do you want to run on the fact that you didn't vote for this thing? My guess is they're not going to vote on ideology. They're going to vote on whether or not it would cost them an election. And I think the whole way that it's been set up gives them a lot of opportunities to say, well, I'm not voting for it, and here's why. And I hope my constituents back in Kentucky or wherever kind of get that.
Yeah, and I think it really does get to a lot of the things, Susan, we talk about at the state level, too, is if you say often enough that you're going to do something, but then that thing never really materializes, and people don't notice it, frankly, you can say, well, look, I supported the thing that never got passed. And then you're able to go back and say, oh, this is great. We took on Obamacare, just didn't do anything about it.
Right. I think that in a perfect world, this would have died in the House for Mitch McConnell if it would have died in the House, and he would never have had to actually deal with it. Maybe the hope is that this doesn't quite go far. It doesn't actually pass. It doesn't get but still, I think that he's walking, and all Republicans are walking this tightrope between their base, which really wants to see Obamacare repealed. They've been told it's terrible, and they've been told it's going to be repealed as soon as the Republicans get into power. So if it doesn't happen, there's going to be a backlash against that. But on the other hand, they're going to pass this bill, whatever it is and however bad it is, and there's going to be a backlash against that. So it's really a rock and a hard place situation.
Speaking of a rock and the hard place, Governor Malloy, of course, facing all sorts of criticism from business groups and people from outside the state saying that Connecticut's not business friendly. Well, once again, Florida Governor Rick Scott comes back. He's coming back to the state in order to try to poach our companies. He wants to take companies like Aetna and General Electric. They might not move to Florida, but he's pouncing on that and coming here, Colin, and saying, look, it's time to relocate to Florida because you can't do business in Connecticut.
Right. The slogan that he used was, or at least the phrase that he used was, give up. Come to Florida, which you certainly have given up, probably, if that's the decision that you make. I was also kind of astonished that three Republican legislators hosted or at least kind of participated in one of his events here in the state. That seems kind of a strange thing to do if you represent the state, is to host a guy who wants to take business away from the state that you represent.
It actually kind of does. I'll say last week at the International Festival of Arts and Ideas down in New Haven, I hosted a talk with Robert Shiller, the acclaimed academic economist, who's writing about narrative economics. And his idea, Kevin, right now is, you know, the stories we tell ourselves about the economy are really, really important. And if we have Republicans at the state level continuing to tell the story, bringing in Rick Scott, that it's a terrible place. It's a terrible place to do business. You know what? It turns into a terrible place over time.
Yeah, and I would be convinced by that argument. But at the same time, if you think things are wrong, right, if you're a Republican legislator who thinks ideologically that the way Connecticut is governing itself is driving businesses out, and you have some evidence of that that's occurring, why not bring in somebody who's been successful, at least according to what he said, been successful on transforming a state that was in a deep recession and during the Great Recession, just before he became governor? Why not bring him in and with the expectation or the hope that you can convince people that there's a different approach that should be taken here in Connecticut?
But that different approach seems to be, why don't you leave Connecticut and go to Florida, which doesn't seem like that's such a great idea. Connecticut has such a morale problem. We're so down on ourselves that I feel like adding to that is just, it's reckless.
Well, I haven't spoken to these Republican legislators, but I wouldn't think that they don't want them to leave. They just want to be sort of scared, right? They're scared with the potential. They want the citizens of Connecticut to be scared that the potential of companies will leave, and they have evidence that they have left. So therefore, you need to change things. This is sort of shock therapy.
Just say we just have 30 seconds, Colin. But I mean, a lot of this gets to what we're going to talk about in the last segment, this idea of fake news. I mean, there's a lot of question about how many millionaires and billionaires are leaving Connecticut. I mean, not everyone believes the numbers that the Republicans always talk about around this.
Right. I just read somewhere that there are more billionaires in Greenwich alone than there were billionaires in the state before Malloy got into office. So it's unclear that this billionaire migration is actually taking place.
This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Kevin McMahon. He's a political science professor at Trinity College. Susan Bigelow, who writes for ctnewsjunkie.com, and also our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We talked about this a little bit last week, but we sort of wanted to see what and hear what happened. Megyn Kelly, the brand new NBC host, who for a long time was a fixture on Fox, sat down with Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist, for a long-form interview on her brand new program. The local affiliate, NBC Connecticut, decided not to air that interview, in part because of complaints coming from Sandy Hook families, amongst the many horrible, baseless things that Alex Jones has said in his life. He claimed that the shooting at Sandy Hook didn't happen. And when asked by Megyn Kelly, he didn't exactly back down. He said some things that were a little confusing, which we can talk about, and he certainly didn't apologize. It raised a lot of questions about whether or not the local affiliate should have aired that segment, whether or not Megyn Kelly should have given the spotlight to Alex Jones. And now that we've actually seen the thing, Colin, I mean, what's your response? What did you think about what happened there on Sunday?
I think my position hardened a little bit. I mean, I sort of went into this with the position that reasonable people really may come to very different conclusions about this. And I certainly do understand the position of the Sandy, at least I hope I understand the position of the Sandy Hook family. So there isn't every single person from Sandy Hook or every single parent from Sandy Hook who feels that way. And I don't know, I can't remember whether I mentioned this last week or not, but, you know, at least. And this is an example of why Alex Jones does need to be looked at, is the penetration of Alex Jones, the degree to which his message is out there. It has passed the point at which it could be reined in by just ignoring Alex Jones. I don't think that ever really worked. I mean, basically, the mass media ignored Alex Jones from 2001 to, you know, sometime around, you know, midpoint of the 2016 election. And guess what happened? He got really popular, and his ideas got in heavy circulation. And so I don't know. When I saw what Megyn Kelly did, I mean, it wasn't perfect, and it wasn't maybe exactly how, you know, I would have wanted her to handle this. But it was a pretty tough piece. It seemed to be aimed at exposing exactly how weird and opportunistic Jones is, how reckless he is at slinging stuff around, and then exploring that kind of post-factual element that links him to a lot of the things that Donald Trump does. And she really did do, I think, a nice job of laying out the connections between Jones and Trump in a way that might have been helpful to some people.
Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Colin on this. I think going back to Louis Brandeis, who said sunshine is the best disinfectant, right? That when you have ideas that are that you might view as strange, that you might view as problematic, that factually incorrect, that the best way to deal with this is not to put it aside, not to say it'll go away, but actually to challenge those ideas, to make the person articulating those ideas defend him or herself, right? Only when you do that, and I thought Megyn Kelly did a good job on that. I thought she made him look silly at various times. When you do that, that's the best way to undermine the person's credibility, not to hope he just goes away.
And I have my own thoughts on this, and I want to hear from Susan first, because I don't know necessarily she made him look silly. He does a great job of that himself and doesn't really need her help. But anyway.
No, I mean, he doesn't, though, but he still has all these fans because, again, it's all about conspiracy theory thinking. And if you're somebody who's deep into this conspiracy theory world, and this is a lot of people at this point who believe in these things that he says and believe in all kinds of other conspiracies and all kinds of other counterfactual things, it's really hard to break them away from that. And an interview like this, well, it does have its uses. That's not going to change people's minds because it's so easy for those conspiracy theory-minded people to say, well, she just ambushed him, or this was just a hit job. They won't even watch it. They'll just pay attention to what he says about it afterwards. So, well, we hope that sunshine's the best disinfectant. I wonder if in our age where you can very easily go back into that very comfortable space of online conspiracy theory world, if it's really going to change any minds.
Well, and you use sunshine as the best disinfectant. I think that part of the problem for me is the way that this was set up by Megyn Kelly and NBC. She actually talked about shining a light on Alex Jones, and I think some people say, you know, it's about uncovering a rock and finding out what's underneath. That's an exploration. Sunshine being the best disinfectant is a way of saying that more light is better than less light. But when you say you're going to shine a light, another way to think about it, I think the way that the Sandy Hook families are thinking about it, is you're giving a spotlight to a guy who already has millions and millions of viewers and followers and listeners, and you're giving him a different sort of platform. This is indeed someone I think we need to remember, and Megyn Kelly did a good job of outlining this, who in essence, with his words, weaponized an individual to go into a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., and examine it for himself with a gun, which he fired into the air. Luckily, nobody was hurt. The idea that speech can weaponize individuals who believe certain things that aren't true is actually a very dangerous precedent to set. I love some of Colin's thoughts on this, but I think that that's a big worry for me as far as the sunlight piece of this. Right. You're bringing into the sunlight a lot of toxic ideas that people might indeed take way too far.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a risk. I mean, in democracies, there are risks that what you consider to be bad ideas win the day. But you have to be confident in your own arguments, right? You need to be able to convince those people who may not be. I mean, probably many viewers of NBC are not necessarily aware of Alex Jones, right? So you understand that there's going to be a contingent of people who believe in conspiracy theory. I think I read a recent statistic that 13-14% of Americans believe in Bigfoot, right? So they're going to be out there. But the question is, do they expand? So you try to prevent the expansion by saying that what this person is saying is simply wrong, incorrect, and show why that's the case.
And I think that a big difference is just in what Kevin pointed out, Colin, which is a lot of people believe in Bigfoot. Somebody like Richard Spencer believes that the white race is better than the other races. Those are about beliefs, and I think that those are things that we need to uncover. The difference is what Alex Jones says is, I have pictures of Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. I have evidence that Bigfoot exists, and it's a lie, and it's bad information. If we as news people had a source that we knew was a liar and who gave us bad information, we would abandon that source. We wouldn't use that source because the source would be giving us bad information. And I feel like Megyn Kelly took a bad source and put him on a very big platform to spew ideas that aren't his beliefs, but were what he calls facts that other people can just then go disprove.
Yeah, the problem is that Jones isn't just a source of information. He's now a part of sort of loosely organized machine that, among other things, helped Donald Trump win this election.
Yes.
So it's not just that he's a source. He has a real impact on the political process. I think also, you know, it gets very complicated when we start talking about that gatekeeping function. Let me give you a few examples that come kind of from the other side of the aisle, although I actually do think Jones is kind of post-political. I think you can find a lot of people who are left of center who are interested in a lot of the same things that he is. I mean, look, Jill Stein during the campaign called for a new investigation of 9/11. It feels like we don't really understand what happened at 9/11. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a leading force, and I was going to be on some Trump commission. I don't know if that ever happened or not, but a leading force with this whole argument that vaccines cause autism. You know, these are, as far as I'm concerned, kind of wackadoodle ideas. They come from maybe slightly more prestigious sources than Alex Jones, assuming that you think Jill Stein is that. But, like, what are we going to do? Are we going to say, well, that's just cockamamie stuff, we're not going to write about it? No, I think ultimately you have to take Jill Stein's claims or Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s claims and say this is what either stands or falls. I mean, I think that's our only option is to do that.
Yeah, and I guess I just wonder is does it rise to a different level when Jill Stein is a candidate for president of the United States and is running for office, or when someone is going to be appointed into a cabinet position? This is not somebody, Susan, who is in government right now. This is not somebody who we've given some sort of authority to. You question, I think, people who are in power differently than people who hope to have power, who are, through their own words, trying to gain power. To me, that's just, as an interviewer, a different sort of matrix and a different way of looking at it. I don't know your take.
My take is that it should have been on, like, The Daily Show, that would have been, I think, the best place for it, where I think the best way to counter these people is to kind of mock them, to show people just how silly and bizarre they are. And I don't know. I think that the Megyn Kelly interview probably gave it a little more legitimacy than it necessarily had to have.
And again, we wouldn't have gotten it on The Daily Show, in part because of, you know, what we read. Alex Jones, of course, tried to use this to his own advantage, kind of gaming Megyn Kelly, releasing a lot of tapes before the interview actually went out, some tapes of conversations they had in which she said things like, I'm not looking to portray you as some sort of boogeyman or do any sort of gotcha moment. I just want to talk about you. I want people to get to know you. And the craziest thing of all would be if some of the people who have this insane version of you in their heads walk away saying, you know what? I see the dad in him. I see the guy who loves his kids and is more complex than I've been led to believe. That doesn't sound to me, Kevin, like someone who is trying to do an in-depth analysis of a person's pathology. It sounds to me like someone who's trying to get somebody on the television.
Yeah, I mean, how this is done is something that I'm sure you guys know better than I. But, you know, what she actually did in the interview was not really what she was saying in the quote that you just read. I mean, so there are two different things, right? In the sense of what you might say to somebody to convince him to come on your show, and what the interview actually turns out to be. And I thought, you know, it was you know, if I was a fan of him, which I'm certainly not, I would not have been fond. You know, I would not have been happy in viewing that.
Because another thing that you don't do in our business, Colin, certainly, is say we're going to treat you one way and then treat you another way. That's actually another way to betray a source if you're Alex Jones or anybody else. But anyway, I clearly have strong feelings about the way Megyn Kelly handled this.
Right. Well, we're not supposed to do that, but I'm sure. I mean, Alex Jones is unusual in terms of miking this whole process, and I don't know what Lowell Bergman, you know, has done in over the course of his career, or Don Hewitt, or anybody. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, shading, maybe not as dramatic as that. But it seems to me that, you know, at some point Megyn Kelly is being kind of damned both ways. That, I mean, Alex Jones's big complaint is he was promised a much more softball interview, you know, and she just buzzed a whole bunch of pitches at his head. So, I mean, so that's his perception. It tends to militate against the argument that Megyn Kelly was the wrong person to do this and that she was going to be or was too easy on Alex Jones. He sure as hell doesn't think so. However, it should be noted, he has a real interest in picking fights with mainstream media, because part of his big argument is the mainstream media suppresses all this stuff, you know, that Megyn Kelly is a representative of an organization that keeps these important truths about 9/11 and Barack Obama's birthplace and Sandy Hook and all this other stuff, you know, out of the people's hands. So he wins if he can get into a fight with her.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, Susan, maybe we can leave it at that, but he he wins by getting on NBC with Megyn Kelly, which is, I guess, part of the issue that I, as one of the gatekeepers, have with the entire thing. The idea that we make decisions to let people on and game what he calls the mainstream media derisively, what I think a lot of the rest of us think of as the legitimate media, in which we ask hard questions and we try to get to real truths. So we don't just say, well, somebody told me this, and so therefore we can I can play devil's advocate for an hour and make up untruths.
Yeah, and I think that this all goes back again to a cultural conflict where there are a lot of people in this country who look at what they call the mainstream media and see a force that is telling lies and is not telling the truth and is shading things and has a bias, whether or not that's true or not. So that cultural, that's something that Alex Jones is really good at tapping into, is that kind of cultural narrative.
Yeah, and just one more point. I mean, I think what the question you were asking earlier with regard to people who are in a position or are running for a position, there's sort of formal power, right? Alex Jones seems to have some informal power. He seems to be connected in some way to President Trump. So to me, that's even more important. If that's actually true, if there is a link there, it should be exposed. And therefore, the interview, maybe she's not the most best person to do the interview, but it's a beginning. It's a start. And so I see no problem with it.
And I will say, Colin, and you and I agree with this certainly, that I think she did a very good job of pointing out those connections to Donald Trump.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I mean, I think it's important to also understand that you know people who think these things. You may not have conversations with them. I guarantee you know some people who think that 9/11 has been a completely misrepresented event in human history. You might know somebody who's a Sandy Hook hoax believer. It's maybe not the kind of thing that comes up in a conversation, though.
Well, we're going to leave our conversation at that, and thanks for listening.